If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorn. Can you learn about the medieval mindset by spending time with modern monks? Today's guest, Dr. Benjamin Pohl, has done exactly that in the course of his research into medieval abbots and their role in writing history. He spoke to our content director, Dave Musgrove, to explain more.
Today I'm talking to Dr. Benjamin Pohl, Senior Lecturer in Medieval History at the University of Bristol. Ben, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Well, not at all. Thank you for having me.
Now, you've been working on a research project, which is shortly going to see the publication of a book, Medieval Abbots and the Writing of History. It's all about how and why medieval monks, and specifically abbots, got involved in the writing of history. Part of the project also involved you spending a week at a monastic retreat with the monks of Downside Abbey, which we'll want to hear about a bit later on. Now, I'm just going to drop in a couple of quotes from some of the project data. The project showcases Benedictine monasteries as centres of history where historical knowledge has been collected and cultivated for centuries, and you've been exploring how and why medieval Benedictine abbots engaged firsthand with the writing of history by recording the traditions and collective memories of their monastic communities. So that sounds pretty interesting to me, but let's get back into the story. Let's centre our listeners here. So can you take us back to the start of the story, remind us the origins of Benedictine monasteries, how far they spread geographically, how important they were in the fabric of medieval society, and the role of abbots, particularly within them?
I'm going to do something that is perhaps not particularly popular with radio listeners and students by starting with a caveat, so occupational hazard of a historian. Because the term Benedictine monasticism or Benedictine abbots and monks is actually more of a sort of catch-all phrase that we use for ease of reference. And we must not think of it as a stable phenomenon that was sort of universal or ubiquitous in character. But actually what we're talking about is a panorama of religious communal lifestyles that developed in a lot of different directions and experimentally as well over many centuries across the medieval period and indeed beyond. But it is a term, of course, that both in common parlor and in the academic world is used as a convenient shorthand. And this is how we're going to use it, I think, for the conversation as well. even though scholars lately have tried to come up with alternative, more precise terms. But I think it'll do for us today. And of course, what we associate when we talk or hear about Benedictine monasticism or monasticisms are two things. It's St. Benedict himself and the rule of St. Benedict. And this takes us back into the early medieval period, into the later 5th and 6th centuries, with Benedict. As far as we know, most of the information we actually have about Benedict himself as a historical person and his deeds come from the dialogues of Pope Gregory the Great, written with a particular agenda of presenting Benedict as this pious model of a man and religious charismatic leader. And founder of a whole series of monasteries, including, of course, the monastery of Monte Cassino, where he then became the first abbot. And as far as we know, and if we can believe Gregory's testimony, wrote the Rule of St. Benedict as a set of principles for communal religious life. Applicable, by the way, to both male and female communities. So you know, not just talking or thinking about monks, we're equally talking about religious women. And that is important for me to stress as well, that the project looks not just at male abbots, but also at their female counterparts, at abbesses.
Ah, okay. So we've gone back to like the early medieval period, the 5th, 6th centuries there. So how far and wide did these did the rule of Benedict and these monasteries that followed his rule go into play?
That is the interesting thing here, because the rule of St. Benedict is neither the only, nor indeed the first, rule set down in writing about the principles of monastic life, but is one of many, and actually preceded by several from as early as about the 4th century. And a lot of this early development of monasticism takes place outside of Western Europe, particularly in the Middle East. So we have Syria and Palestine, we have North Africa, and then from about relatively early on, also in parts of Gaul and Italy. The special thing, if you like, about the Rule of St. Benedict is less its content, but the story of its success, that it would be the one rule prevailing for many centuries, up to a point where shortly after about the year 1000, it can claim more or less a monopoly in most of the Latin West until about the 12th century, when we have new experiments in communal religious living taking place and spreading across Europe. So it's the longevity and actually the widespread nature of religious communities following the principles, not necessarily always to the letter, I should say as well, but adopting them and adapting them creatively to meet their own regional or local circumstance that makes the Rule of St. Benedict so interesting to study. So we shouldn't think of it as, even though it is, of course, a guideline for monastic life and a widely subscribed one, we shouldn't think of it as too rigorous in its application or adoption across the medieval world.
Okay, so you've just said there, so around about the year 1000, Benedictine monasticism, or monasticisms, as if we're following the academic rigor there, is the main form of monasticism in Western Europe. Important in the fabric of medieval society. What's it doing? What's its role in medieval society?
It has a lot of roles, as a matter of fact, and I have to take you back slightly before the turn of the millennium to explain some of this, into the Carolingian period. So Charlemagne and his immediate successors, particularly Louis the Pious, where we see this incentive of combining religious reform, monastic reform in particular, with very concrete politics, where we have what we might in modern parlor call, you know, state dynamics and the state apparatus actually employing and actively promoting this particular style of religious living and the particular sets of principles and rules associated therewith, in order to achieve something resembling unity across the Carolingian Empire. And that means, of course, that unlike the very early forms of monasticism, where you have people living very remotely and almost, though quite never, in perfect isolation from the main centers of society, we now get a very strong connection between the secular world and the religious world, wherein these monasteries play a range of functions. For example, by hosting powerful guests and visitors, by having patrons from the very upper echelons of society, but having founders who are themselves members of royal or aristocratic families and who plant, if you like, their own dynastic policies and personnel within these monasteries. So it's quite important for us to realize that these monasteries don't exist in isolation from society, but actually play a very crucial part in the very center of society at the time.
Okay, so that's good. So we've centered ourselves there, but then we also need to understand the role of abbots and abbesses, as you said, as heads of these communities. So what did an abbot or abbess actually do?
Well, again, if we look back into, say, the rule of St. Benedict and some of the other monastic codes of the early medieval period, the word abbot and abbess comes from Aramaic, Abba and Amma, which are the words for father and mother. And this is very important for our understanding of monasticism or monasticisms, that these are father and mother figures. First of all, they are responsible for the communities and everybody they're in. They need to lead the communities by word and deed. So they need to set an example of pious living for their monks and nuns. But of course, they also play a range of other functions. They have, especially from the Carolingian period onwards and into the second millennium, an increasing amount of administrative responsibility, with their abbeys and monasteries acquiring more and more land and wealth and property, communal property, because of course individual property is not permitted within these monastic communities. So they become, in many ways, diplomats, they become administrators, but they also become charismatic religious leaders and reformers. So it's a very complex role with a lot of responsibility for them to represent and lead their communities, both in this world and then, of course, looking forward in the medieval mind, also towards salvation and the continuity of their communities into the next world.
Okay, so these people have got a pretty big job. They're important figures in the community. Now, to get to the nub of your research and looking at the writing of history by these people, was it stated anywhere that abbots or indeed monks, the monks beneath them, had any sort of duty to record or write history?
The simple answer is no, it was not. And this might strike us as surprising, because even if we look into particularly the early monastic rules and customs, there is, as you say, there's nowhere any indication that writing history should be part of the daily duty of a monk, an abbot, a nun, or an abbess. So the question, of course, then would be, why did they do it? And this leads us into, I think, the very heart of the research that I did with this project and I'm currently writing up for the book. And it's not easy to give a simple answer, as you might imagine, because, you know, there's a whole range of motivations for people for writing history, both in the Middle Ages and today. But when it comes to abbots and abbesses in particular, we can define across the map, if we look across medieval Europe, as I do in the book. So I set very wide chronological and geographic parameters that capture most of northwestern Europe, with occasional forays into southern Europe and central Europe as well, and into Scandinavia. We do see that certain motivations seem to be paramount. And they have to do, and this leads back to what I said earlier, with the different forms of involvement that these men and women have, both within their communities, but also within wider society. So some of them write history to provide their communities with a written version of the past and their place in it, almost a sense of belonging, if you want. Others write history, and this is not exclusive, some of them do both. Others write history related to the families of the founders and foundresses and the benefactors of their monasteries. Others write even more wide-ranging, universal histories and chronicles. So there's a whole range of histories that these abbots write. And the motivations are, in many ways, as individual as they are for any other type of writing. So it's very difficult to pinpoint and perhaps futile to try and pinpoint one motivation for all abbots and abbesses that wrote history across Europe over centuries.
And were they? So you've just said that there was lots of different things they were doing, lots of reasons they were doing it for. So this question is slightly silly then, but what they produced, was it different to what monks or nuns were producing? Because they were also producing works of history.
Not in principle. And what I mean by this is, if you looked at a, say, at a chronicle or history written by an abbot or abbess, without knowing by whom it was written, and put it next to another chronicle or work of history written by a monk or a nun or somebody else entirely, you wouldn't necessarily be able to tell the difference straight away from the way it looks or the form it takes. But what I want to showcase with that project is that it didn't matter whether the author or indeed commissioner of this history was an abbot or abbess, not so much by virtue of the internal qualities of the works, but by how they used their authority, the resources at their disposal as leaders of these communities to support the writing of history, to facilitate and promote it. So it's actually more of a whole apparatus of historiographical projects that matters to me, rather than necessarily only the individual works. And this is where abbots and abbesses really become a case apart, because they have the authority by virtue of their standing within the communities, by virtue of their social-political influence, to commission these histories, either from members of their own communities, if indeed there are any capable of doing so, or indeed by bringing in people from external places, by, you know, looking outside the cloister, and pay or otherwise compel men and women to write history for them. So it's this influence, this authority, those resources that are really interesting for me, and to see how they are deployed strategically by abbots and abbesses in a very holistic way, not just by putting pen to parchment themselves, but also by being patrons, by being commissioners, by being intellectual architects, by being project managers of historical writing. So it's a much bigger understanding of what writing history actually is and does, than simply thinking of, perhaps in the modern sense, of a historian who sits down almost in perfect isolation with a bunch of books.
Yeah. Okay, we'll come back to the process of writing and how they actually did it in a second. But am I right in thinking you found around about 70 examples of abbots and abbesses who produced historical works?
That was the first sort of ballpark figure when I started the project.
Have we got a higher number now?
Expanded. So basically, well, we're well in the three digits by now.
Okay.
Especially as a result of what I just said, where even for abbots and abbesses who write themselves, who are what we might call authors today, these are already well over 100 across the Middle Ages and across the Latin West. But once we add these abbots and abbesses acting in these other capacities, the numbers become even greater. You know, the ones that commission, the ones that patronize, the ones that support. I'm in the book having the very challenging, if quite thankful, task of condensing this mass of really big data into an argument and a narrative that can be developed on the basis of key examples of individuals and particular communities that I, based on the research I've done, consider to be representative of a broader situation.
And from that 100 or so group of people you found, are there any particularly notable or colourful figures who you think our listeners might be interested in?
Well, there are many. And it's a difficult task, like with the book, to cherry pick the ones that I think might make for a particularly good story. But one I would like to highlight here is Abbot Aegil of Fulda, Carolingian period. He's the fourth abbot of Fulda. And indeed,
where's Fulda?
Fulda is in Germany, in what is today Germany, and actually not very far from the place I am from myself. So there's a joy of being able to research something that used to be on my doorstep for so many years, even though when I was younger, I couldn't be less interested in Fulda or its monastery. But that fortunately has changed over the years. And the interesting thing here is that what Aegil does when he, shortly after he becomes the fourth abbot of Fulda, is he sets out to write down an account of the life and deeds of the first abbot of Fulda, Stormi or Stormius, who was a kinsman of his. So that it's a close family relation going on there as well. But not enough. On top of that, he also appoints another monk within Fulda's monastic community to write the lives and deeds of the second and third abbots of Fulda, respectively. So what, in practice, what Aegil achieves is he sets or establishes the very basis for a serial history of abbots of Fulda by writing the very first one himself, almost, I believe, as a model for the second and the third to follow in his own lifetime. And then the person who writes these other second and third abbatial vita then also writes Aegil's own life after his death. So by the end of that, we have histories of the first four abbots of Fulda, which then gets continued in subsequent generations and expanded. So in a way, we can really see this particular abbot drawing on all his resources and abilities, both as an author himself, but also as somebody who actually has the authority to appoint somebody else to continue his work. And on top of that, he does something extremely interesting, which is he builds, and I mean this in the literal sense, he builds a historical environment within which these histories are located. For example, he finishes a project initiated by his predecessors, which is the Great Basilica of Fulda, within which he relocates the remains, the venerated remains of this first abbot, and gives them a very prominent place for veneration, both by members of the community and by pilgrims. He builds a second church in the monastic graveyard that he models on the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem and establishes as a final resting place for Fulda's abbots, almost as if to take this serial history and locate it physically within the monastic landscape where it can be experienced by walking around, by looking around. And again, both for members of the community itself, but also for visitors, for guests, for powerful patrons, and really showcase this powerhouse that Fulda is becoming in that period from all angles and situating it very firmly within the history, both of the monastery itself, but also of the wider world.
So it sounds like this is all about stressing the importance of a monastic institution and the venerability of it and you know, bigging up the founders and the benefactors. Is that one of the key motivations behind this chap and the other writers for what they're trying to do?
This is part of it, yes. So, and this is a debate that's been going on for a long, long time, but that seems to have flared up particularly in the last few years with a few very important key publications in the field of medieval history that have turned specifically to look at how individual monastic communities have dealt with, construed sometimes their own narratives of the past. And pleasing or incorporating powerful benefactors and founders, aristocratic families, dynasties, royal houses, is one of the motivations, alongside many others. Another motivation that we find stressed quite frequently in scholarship is overcoming moments of crisis, collective crisis that can either arise by internal struggle or through external challenges brought onto the community. For example, if their possessions or their lands are being challenged by a local secular prince or a bishop and things like that. And what I would like to do with the book is also to call for a bit of caution with this, because I think it is very easy and in some cases perfectly accurate to emphasize crisis as a motivator for writing history. But I think it is also very simplistic if we do it sort of as a matter of course. And I think we do these monks and nuns and abbots and abbesses injustice if we think that crisis is the prime motivator for them to pick up the pen and write down their own history. I think there's a much more intrinsic, there's a much more organic motivation at work as to why they want their histories to be put into writing. And this has to do with questions of identity that are rooted much more deeply than just as a pragmatic tool of resolving a particular conflict. You know, it's not just a hammer to crack a nut. It's something that is much more important and has a much more central place within religious life, both in the Middle Ages and today, than we could possibly express by looking only at history as a response to some sort of stimulus.
Got it. Right. So I want to just spend a few minutes just trying to understand how these histories were produced, what the process was, and what the understanding of history as a term was at the time. So the Fulda example you just gave there, it sounded a little bit like journalism more than history, in the sense that he was quite close to the period of Stormius, just three generations back. I guess he was getting oral testimony to inform himself. So what were the sources that were being used, and what was the general understanding of what history was all about? Like how interested were people in factual accuracy? I guess, were they making stuff up?
It's very interesting. This is a question we always address very early to our students who study medieval history and medieval historiographical sources, that there is, of course, an understanding of what history, or at least good history, should be in the medieval period, just as there is today. And whilst it shares certain features with what today we expect of a historian, it is also quite distinct. Because whereas you find in a lot of prologues and prefaces of medieval historical narratives, you find topoi and commonplaces where they stress that, of course, only the truth must be written and we must not include any fiction and we must not make anything up or falsify. That is all very true. And that is, I guess, in many regards, also what these writers actually did, or at least attempted to do. But the notion of truth itself that we're dealing with here is quite distinct from the notion of, say, factual accuracy or objectivity, as we often understand it and actually tend to expect it from historians today. And, you know, it is, of course, a perfect illusion that any historian, medieval or modern, could write entirely free of bias or subjectivity, because we're all shaped by the circumstances within which we write, and how we were brought up, the societies in which we live. But we try to distance ourselves, today at least, as much as possible from the subject matter of the histories that we write. And this is not something that we should expect from medieval historians, that sense of distance. There's quite often a very obvious connection, a bias that can be very unapologetically applied to a work. And you remember early on, we talked a bit about St. Benedict himself and how he was described and perhaps shaped into this larger-than-life figure by Gregory the Great. And there's no question there that Gregory meant to write down what he considered as truth. But at the same time, of course, he did write with a very clear bias that is evident to anyone reading his dialogues. So we're dealing with a very different understanding of historical truth that is not more or less true than any history we write or read today, but it's very different.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
Whereas the monastic understanding of time, both medieval and modern, in many ways, is very cyclical in nature. Not just if you look at the repetitive nature of the church year and the feasts and all of that and the calendars, but also how every individual day is designed around certain hours of prayer, certain hours for activities, and that repeats itself.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
So just to drill into that idea of truth just a little bit closer. So there were secular historians at the time, people who weren't involved in religious life, who weren't involved in monastic communities writing history. Is there any difference in the sort of the objectivity, the understanding of truth, or the interest in being honest between a secular person writing history and someone from a monastic community?
There are, surely, there are differences here. One thing to remember is, however, that even secular writers at the time, except perhaps for the very end of the Middle Ages, and even there to a point, I guess, they still live within a society that is heavily shaped by religion. So just because they're not part of a religious community, like a monastery or similar, that doesn't mean they don't operate along similar lines when it comes to, you know, conceptualizing the role of an individual or society on a larger path that ultimately is geared towards salvation. Right? So this is why you quite often in scholarship find history written in the medieval period expressed as salvation history. And whilst there are, of course, important nuances here, at least in the Christian Latin tradition, this is a very powerful motive that can be found even in the writings of secular writers. But yes, you're absolutely right. If we look into monastic communities, we can, of course, and we should expect a lot more and perhaps more explicit dealings with the fact that human life, especially as it was led by monks, nuns, abbots and abbesses, is, of course, almost entirely geared towards serving God through everyday labor, prayer, liturgy and other activities, and therefore quite naturally claims a very prominent position within the motivation of these histories.
So the Fulda example you gave earlier was fairly on in our period, so 8th century, I think, around about that. So presumably at that point there weren't that many documents or manuscripts available in the library at Fulda. Perhaps there were. Perhaps I'm wrong. But as we progress through the period, one would imagine there'd be more and more documents, more and more things produced, more sources for the abbots and the abbesses to rely on. So does the process of writing history become different as they have more background material to delve into as we move through the medieval period?
Just to start with a quick observation, actually Fulda has a remarkably large library in this period, one of the biggest and perhaps most well-equipped one, and also one that has left us, albeit in fragmentary fashion, a few inventories or even catalogues, as we might want to call them. So it's a bit of a case apart, but of course, yes, generally as the sheer amount of written material increases, you find that more and more writers are obviously able to rely on previous works, which they might continue or redact or even employ in their own writing. Whereas, particularly in the sort of very early medieval period, you have more writers, I think, within these individual monastic communities who have to translate what would have been oral tradition into a first written history of their community, usually around three generations into the community. Sort of a threshold that we see in quite a lot of them, where oral information is at the risk of being forgotten and therefore has to be made durable and enshrined in writing, which doesn't render it, you know, entirely stable forevermore. And of course, it can be questioned, it can be modified. But this initial act of codification, of putting something into writing, is a very important one. As we then move forward through the medieval period, and these institutional and in many cases private libraries as well grow, we see, especially if you think about the later 12th and then into the 13th and 14th centuries, the rise of the universities and education for members of those monastic communities as well, where many monks go and study at universities, including their abbots. We see perhaps a very different use of the written word than we see in earlier centuries.
Thinking about the wider picture here, how far did the histories written by these abbots and abbesses disseminate across medieval society? Were they sort of contained within their institutions, or did they spread out? Did they affect or impact on the way that other people understood the history of those institutions, or more widely, history in general?
It always depends a bit what kind of history we're looking at. If it is an internal house chronicle, or as I said, for Fulda, these lives of the earliest abbots, these are texts which are primarily of interest to members of these communities themselves, which doesn't mean they don't get disseminated and read elsewhere necessarily, but the chances of that happening are much smaller, obviously, than if you have, say, an abbot or abbess write a universal chronicle that pertains to a much wider territory and also to a much longer chronology, potentially. So some of these works get read and copied and disseminated virtually across medieval Europe, resulting in hundreds of manuscripts that survive, whereas others survive in very, very small numbers, sometimes only in the autographs, as in the books or individual sheets of parchment written by their authors. And sometimes they don't survive at all, where the only evidence we have for them are through library inventories, book lists, or because somebody else told us that Abbess X or Abbot X wrote something, but we have no trace of the text anymore. So the dissemination very much depends on what kind of history it is and how wide an interest it caters to.
So I guess that's kind of the fun and the frustration of your research project, is you're seeing little hints and tidbits of sources that you're probably never going to see.
Oh yes, and it is. There's many a rabbit hole in that as well, where you end up chasing quite obscure references and make your way through these days, fortunately, increasingly digitized repositories of medieval manuscripts across the world. And or catalogues to find, if any, very remote traces of a text. But quite often, yes, this can lead to a situation where we are in no position anymore to establish what a particular abbot or abbess wrote. But in other instances, for example, we have a very clear and good sense, because these texts fortunately have come down to us in more or less complete versions.
And in terms of those complete versions, I suppose the fragments that you talk about, what do these surviving sources tell us about the nature of medieval monasticism and or medieval society as a whole? What's the bigger picture that we ought to be aware of?
that's a very big question. That I guess for me, looking into chronicles and other historical narratives written within monasteries, and particularly for this project, by abbots and abbesses, or at the commission, at the request, or with the support of these individuals, tells us, I think, a lot about some of the structural ways in which religious communities that we perhaps traditionally, and certainly in the more public awareness, I guess, think of as quite distanced from the rest of society, actually interlink very actively, not just with one another by forming networks, but also with princely and royal courts, with emerging urban centres, and with all levels and all strata of society by virtue of writing history.
Now, one of the really interesting things that you did in this research project, as I mentioned in the introduction, is you spent a week at a monastic retreat at Downside Abbey. So that sounds really interesting. Can you tell us a little bit about Downside and your involvement with them in your research?
Absolutely. Pleasure. Downside Abbey in Stratton-on-the-Foss in Somerset. So not quite on the doorstep. Well, it might be, but it takes a while to get there because of Somerset roads. is which makes it so interesting and made it so interesting for me, a monastic community that is still functioning today. So you still have now an abbot and a group of monks living Benedictine religious life according to more or less the same principles as they were set down in the rule of St. Benedict, as I say, with certain adjustments, but very much in that tradition and consciously so. And it was clear from the very beginning that for a project such as this, where one of the key aims is to find out the communal functions, the communal uses of history and historical writing and historical narratives, to have a community such as Downside and talk to the monks about the role that history plays in their lives today would be an invaluable resource to draw upon. And that is indeed what happened as well. We had we organized a series of events, some public, some internal, workshops, lectures, all sorts, and really became, if I may use the term, a community in our own right of researchers, monks, students, who together, I would like to think, managed to shed light on some of these topics in a way that is almost impossible to do if you do it solely within the confines of a university or even an individual office. And that, to me, was one of the great pleasures of doing this project. And one of the outputs of that is still online and will be all the way till 2025, is an online exhibition, History and Community, 20 exhibits from Downside Abbey, taken from the Abbey's fantastic archives and special collections, but also from all around the monastery. So we have architectural elements in it. We have items of everyday use, material objects, photographs, stories, paintings, drawings, literally anything you can think about that can be situated within a historical context and the way that history matters to the community. And I would encourage all your listeners to have a look at it, because I really believe it is an exhibition of which both I'm not ashamed to say, and I think also the community can be very proud.
We'll attempt to stick a link to that in the show notes. So did you actually live as a monk for a week? What were you doing? How was it helping you to understand? I mean, because you're a historian, and were you able to get a better sense about the monastic historians who your predecessors from actually doing?
I did not live as a monk. I did not dress as a monk either. Which I was very glad about. It was very cold. It was the beginning of the year, January. So the what really for me was the most valuable thing, and that I had been looking forward to the most, was to immerse myself for a week within the monastic routine of doing things, of living life, of structuring an individual day or a whole week. Which is something that, of course, I had read about many a time, but actually doing it really gives you a very different understanding of not just how time works within a religious community, but also of how it influences the view on history more generally. I mean, today we tend to think of history and time very much as a linear development. We start somewhere, day X, and then time will just progress and eventually, at an undefined date, perhaps end at some point or go on forevermore. But that is how we think of time in history generally. And this is what you will find in any history textbook, timelines that are linear, like you can draw them with a ruler. Whereas the monastic understanding of time, both medieval and modern, in many ways is very cyclical in nature. Not just if you look at the repetitive nature of the church year and the feasts and all of that and the calendars, but also how every individual day is designed around certain hours of prayer, certain hours for activities, and that repeats itself. And that repeats itself theoretically forevermore. But of course, there is also an end point which is in itself a cyclical movement because it brings the history of salvation full circle. And some of your listeners might think, oh, we're getting quite sort of esoterical, philosophical, spiritual right now. And this for me was a very, very good experience because I'm personally speaking, I'm not a particularly religious person and wasn't raised that way either. So I can only wholeheartedly recommend that to any historian of medieval religious culture and monasticisms to seek out these opportunities and do a retreat, spend time in an active religious community and get to experience that form of life firsthand.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds absolutely fascinating. Now, I don't know any monks, so I can't be shouted down by them, but are you essentially saying that there's a sense by experiencing modern monasticism in its true form that you can get a better idea of medieval attitudes? Now, that could sound a little bit derogatory to monks. I don't know. That's why I'm worried about. But is there a sense that the continuation of their way of life actually does bring in some elements of a medieval mindset?
Absolutely. And I don't think, and you know, I'm aware I'm speaking on behalf of the monks of Downside here, which I should, of course, not do. But I don't think they'd be offended if they heard you say that, you know, what they do has medieval aspects to it, because it's not really derogatory at all. It's much more a heritage, a tradition that they embrace quite actively, as do most monastic communities, and a heritage that they showcase and are proud of as well, and rightly so. And yes, I do think, whereas experiencing life in a contemporary religious community, in a contemporary monastery, is of course not equivalent to a snapshot from a medieval community, because you know it is not the same. It is similar, but it is not the same. It nevertheless functions according to shared principles that are true and applicable today, just as they were in the age of St. Benedict himself, the Carolingian period, the 11th or 12th centuries, with a certain degree of flexibility and adjustment as required by chronological developments and local specificities, but nevertheless part of a tradition that ultimately points back from our present time all the way into the early Middle Ages.
Excellent. That is really, really interesting. We covered a load of stuff. So when the book Medieval Abbots and the Writing of History, what's the publication date on that? Have we got a timeline? Or is it a cyclical timeline?
A cyclical timeline, yeah. It gets republished constantly. No. I hope to submit the full manuscript before the end of this year. This is the firm plan. And then it is in the hands of the readers and publishers to decide when it might hit the shelves, but hopefully before long.
And you've also got the Cambridge Companion to the Age of William the Conqueror coming out at some point soon.
Yes, that should come out, touch wood, next year.
Okay, brilliant. Well, Benjamin, thank you so much for your time. That's been absolutely fascinating and a real insight into monasticism and the medieval mindset. So thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you.
That was Benjamin Pohl. If you want to look at the online exhibition that Dave and Benjamin discussed, you can find it at historyandcommunity.com. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman and Brittany Colley. Tune in again tomorrow when Dennis Duncan will be speaking about the unexpected history of the Index.